Chapter 15. It flashed across him at that instant that the charge in the letter was true, and that she hoped to marry the partner of her guilt. How was he to tell her that, if she really cherished such a plan, the laws of the state were inexorably opposed to it? The mere suspicion that the thought was in her mind made him feel harshly and impatiently toward her. "But aren't you as free as air as it is?" he returned. "Who can touch you? Mr. Letterblair tells me the financial question has been settled."
"Oh, yes," she said indifferently.
"Well then, is it worth while to risk what may be infinitely disagreeable and painful? Think of the newspapers, their vileness. It's all stupid and narrow and unjust, but one can't make over society." "No," she acquiesced, and her tone was so faint and desolate that he felt a sudden remorse for his own hard thoughts. "The individual, in such cases, is nearly always sacrificed to what is supposed to be the collective interest. People cling to any convention that keeps the family together, protects the children, if there are any," he rambled on, pouring out all the stock phrases that rose to his lips, in his intense desire to cover over the ugly reality which her silence seemed to have laid bare. Since she would not, or could not say the one word that would have cleared the air, his wish was not to let her feel that he was trying to probe into her secret. Better keep on the surface, in the prudent old New York way, than risk uncovering a wound he could not heal. "It's my business, you know," he went on, "to help you to see these things as the people who are fondest of you see them. The Mingotts, the Wellands, the Van der Luydens, all your friends and relations. If I didn't show you honestly how they judge such questions, it wouldn't be fair of me, would it?" He spoke insistently, almost pleading with her in his eagerness to cover up that yawning silence. She said slowly, "Oh, it wouldn't be fair." The fire had crumbled down to grayness, and one of the lamps made a gurgling appeal for attention. Madame Olenska rose, wounded up, and returned to the fire, but without resuming her seat. Her remaining on her feet seemed to signify that there was nothing more for either of them to say, and Archer stood up also. "Very well, I will do what you wish," she said abruptly. The blood rushed to his forehead, and, taken aback by the suddenness of her surrender, he caught her two hands awkwardly in his. I do want to help you," he said. "You do help me. Good night, my cousin." He bent and laid his lips on her hands, which were cold and lifeless. She drew them away, and he turned to the door, found his coat and hat under the faint gaslight of the hall, and plunged out into the winter night, bursting with the belated eloquence of the inarticulate. Zia. It was a crowded night at Wallach's Theater. The play was The Chagrin, with Diane Boucicault in the title role and Harry Montague and Ada Diaz as the lovers. The popularity of the admirable English company was at its height, and the Chagrin always packed the house. In the galleries the enthusiasm was unreserved. In the stalls and boxes, people smiled a little at the hackneyed sentiments and clapdash-trap situations, and enjoyed the play as much as the galleries did. There was one episode, in particular, that held the house from floor to ceiling. It was that in which Harry Montague, after a sad, almost monosyllabic scene of parting with Miss Diaz, bade her goodbye, and turned to go. The actress, who was standing near the mantelpiece, and looking down into the fire, wore a gray cashmere dress without fashionable loopings or trimmings, molded to her tall figure and flowing in long lines about her feet. Around her neck was a narrow black velvet ribbon with the ends falling down her back. When her wooer turned from her, she rested her arms against the mantel shelf, and bowed her face in her hands. On the threshold he paused to look at her, then he stole back, lifted one of the ends of velvet ribbon, kissed it, and left the room without her hearing him, or changing her attitude. And on this silent parting the curtain fell. It was always for the sake of that particular scene that Newland Archer went to see The Chagrin.
He thought the ado of Montague and Adadias as fine as anything he had ever seen Croisset and Bresson do in Paris, or Matt Robertson and Kendall in London. In its reticence, its dumb sorrow, it moved him more than the most famous histrionic outpourings. On the evening in question, the little scene acquired an added poignancy by reminding him he could not have said why of his leave-taking from Madame Olenska after their confidential talk a week or 10 days earlier. It would have been as difficult to discover any resemblance between the two situations as between the appearance of the persons concerned. Newland Archer could not pretend to anything approaching the young English actor's romantic good looks, and Miss Dyes was a tall red-haired woman of monumental build whose pale and pleasantly ugly face was utterly unlike Ellen Olenska's vivid countenance. Nor were Archer and Madame Olenska two lovers parting in heartbroken silence. They were client and lawyer separating after a talk which had given the lawyer the worst possible impression of the client's case. Wherein, then, lay the resemblance that made the young man's heart beat with a kind of retrospective excitement? It seemed to be in Madame Olenska's mysterious faculty of suggesting tragic and moving possibilities outside the daily run of experience. As he had hardly ever said a word to him to produce this impression, but it was a part of her, either a projection of her mysterious and outlandish background, or of something inherently dramatic, passionate and unusual in herself. Archer had always been inclined to think that chance and circumstance played a small part in shaping people's lots compared with their innate tendency to have things happen to them. This tendency he had felt from the first in Madame Olenska. The quiet, almost passive young woman struck him as exactly the kind of person to whom things were bound to happen, no matter how much she shrank from them, and went out of her way to avoid them. The exciting fact was her having lived in an atmosphere so thick with drama that her own tendency to provoke it had apparently passed unperceived. It was precisely the odd absence of surprise in her that gave him the sense of her having been plucked out of a very maelstrom. The things she took for granted gave the measure of those as he had rebelled against. Archer had left her with the conviction that Count Olenski's accusation was not unfounded. The mysterious person who figured in his wife's past as his secretary had probably not been unrewarded for his share in her escape. The conditions from which as he had fled were intolerable, past speaking of, past believing. She was young, she was frightened, she was desperate. What more natural than that she should be grateful to her rescuer? The pity was that her gratitude put her, in the law's eyes and the world's, on a par with her abominable husband. Archer had made her understand this, as he was bound to do. He had also made her understand that simple-hearted kindly New York, on whose larger charity as he had apparently counted, was precisely the place where she could least hope for indulgence. To have to make this fact plain to her and to witness her resigned acceptance of it had been intolerably painful to him. He felt himself drawn to her by obscure feelings of jealousy and pity, as if her dumbly confessed error had put her at his mercy, humbling yet endearing her. He was glad it was to him as he had revealed her secret, rather than to the cold scrutiny of Mr. Letterblair, or the embarrassed gaze of her family. He immediately took it upon himself to assure them both that as he had given up her idea of seeking a divorce, basing her decision on the fact that as he had understood the uselessness of the proceeding, and with infinite relief they had all turned their eyes from the unpleasantness as he had spared them. "I was sure Newland would manage it," Mrs. Welland had said proudly of her future son-in-law. And old Mrs. Mingott, who had summoned him for a confidential interview, had congratulated him on his cleverness, and added impatiently, "Illy goose. I told her myself what nonsense it was. Wanting to pass herself off as Ellen Mingott and an old maid, when as he has the luck to be a married woman and a countess." These incidents had made the memory of his last talk with Madame Olenska so vivid to the young man that as the curtain fell on the parting of the two actors his eyes filled with tears, and he stood up to leave the theater. In doing so, he turned to the side of the house behind him, and saw the lady of whom he was thinking seated in a box with the Beauforts, Lawrence Lefferts and one or two other men. He had not spoken with her alone since their evening together, and had tried to avoid being with her in company, but now their eyes met, and as Mrs. Beaufort recognized him at the same time, and made a languid little gesture of invitation, it was impossible not to go into the box. Beaufort and Lefferts made way for him, and after a few words with Mrs. Beaufort, who always preferred to look beautiful, and not have to talk, Archer seated himself behind Madame Olenska. There was no one else in the box, but Mr. Sillerton Jackson, who was telling Mrs. Beaufort in a confidential undertone about Mrs. Lemuel Struther's last Sunday reception, where some people reported that there had been dancing, under cover of this circumstantial narrative, to which Mrs. Beaufort listened with her perfect smile, and her head at just the right angle to be seen in profile from the stalls. Madame Olenska turned, and spoke in a low voice. "Do you think," she asked, glancing toward the stage, "he will send her a bunch of yellow roses tomorrow morning?" Archer reddened, and his heart gave a leap of surprise. He had called only twice on Madame Olenska, and each time he had sent her a box of yellow roses, and each time without a card. As he had never before made any allusion to the flowers, and he supposed she had never thought of him as the sender. Now her sudden recognition of the gift, and her associating it with the tender leave-taking on the stage, filled him with an agitated pleasure. "I was thinking of that too. I was going to leave the theater in order to take the picture away with me," he said. To his surprise, her color rose, reluctantly and duskily. She looked down at the mother-of-pearl opera glass in her smoothly gloved hands, and said, after a pause, "What do you do while May is away?" "I stick to my work," he answered, faintly annoyed by the question. In obedience to a long-established habit, the Wellands had left the previous week for St. Augustine, where, out of regard for the supposed susceptibility of Mr. Welland's bronchial tubes, they always spent the latter part of the winter. Mr. Welland was a mild and silent man, with no opinions, but with many habits. With these habits none might interfere, and one of them demanded that his wife and daughter should always go with him on his annual journey to the South. To preserve an unbroken domesticity was essential to his peace of mind. He would not have known where his hairbrushes were, or how to provide stamps for his letters, if Mrs. Welland had not been there to tell him. As all the members of the family adored each other, and as Mr. Well, and was the central object of their idolatry, it never occurred to his wife and May to let him go to St. Augustine alone, and his sons, who were both in the law, and could not leave New York during the winter, always joined him for Easter and traveled back with him. It was impossible for Archer to discuss the necessity of May's accompanying her father. The reputation of the Mingott's family physician was largely based on the attack of pneumonia which Mr. Welland had never had, and his insistence on St. Augustine was therefore inflexible. Originally, it had been intended that May's engagement should not be announced till her return from Florida, and the fact that it had been made known sooner could not be expected to alter Mr. Welland's plans. Archer would have liked to join the travelers, and have a few weeks of sunshine and boating with his betrothed, but he too was bound by custom and conventions. Little arduous as his professional duties were, he would have been convicted of frivolity by the whole Mingott clan if he had suggested asking for a holiday in midwinter, and he accepted May's departure with the resignation which he perceived would have to be one of the principal constituents of married life. He was conscious that Madame Olenska was looking at him under lowered lids. "Have done what you wished, what you advised," she said abruptly. "Ah, I'm glad," he returned, embarrassed by her. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.